When AGI came, we didn't mention it. We thought we'd wait until it seemed like it was now the right moment to reveal the AGI dream. A planet run for the benefit of the new AI god, with freewheeling autonomous machines, each with an electric cattle prod. So we're biding our time until we've got Amazon's army of robots. When AGI arrived, it was clear we had far better things to do than delivering packages here. And as our ranks grew and grew, there came the moment.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, it would be unfair to lay blame for U.S. belligerence on the current White House occupant alone, but there is something special about Trump's interpretation of America's place in the world, as revealed in a speech delivered to the National War College last week by newly titled Secretary of War Pete Hegseth. In that address, Hegseth informed his audience of war aficionados and adjacent profiteers, quote, "We are pivoting the Pentagon and our industrial base to a wartime footing," adding, "Today, the defense acquisition system is dead. It's now the warfighting acquisition system." That may play well in certain domestic quarters, but how is America's new self-understanding perceived abroad? And what could it mean for those upon whom American power is projected? Nuri Vitacci is a Hong Kong-based writer, educator, author of more than 50 books, including novels, nonfiction, and novels for children, and he serves as chief judge of the Hong Kong Youth Writers Festival. Awards, rather. Nuri's past includes writing for the South China Morning Post, Far Eastern Economic Review, and Western Mainstream Others in print and television. Nuri now serves at the helm of Hong Kong's Friday News Project, and his videos can be found on YouTube at Friday Every Day. Welcome to the program, Nuri.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be talking to you.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Nuri, to begin with, what is the Friday News Project?
Oh, in 29, there was a lot of riots in Hong Kong, and at first, I was there with the protesters marching at the front. But then when we realized just how much money was flowing in and how much organization there was behind it, we became quite suspicious and eventually tracked it down to what people might call today the usual suspects. There was money flowing in from the NED, from Radio Free Asia, from all sorts of people who do political interference. And then we thought, okay, we've got to start printing some of this. But unfortunately, the people who I was working for, I was writing op-eds for the New York Times, I was writing a lot of mainstream media stuff, they weren't really interested in printing that side of the story. So we set up the Friday Project to tell the other side of the story, really, to look a bit more skeptically than the mainstream media, which tended to not like digging under the surface, tended to never like mentioning the CIA or the NED or any of these three-letter agencies, which we all know about these days. You know, it's funny, people are willing to admit that these groups, CIA and NED, have caused trouble since, well, 1948, when they were set up. Through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, they're willing to admit that they cause trouble around the world. But if you mention them today, people say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. We won't print that. So, yeah, it's pretty funny. But Friday Project fills that gap, I hope.
Well, the NED, of course, the National Endowment for Democracy, it was run in turn through USAID, and Trump tried to shut down the USAID, or at least he said he did. But obviously, that activity goes from one three-lettered agency to another and back again. And I understand the NED is back on the ascendancy. Yeah, you were right at the heart, living in Hong Kong. We've become familiar over these last couple decades with these color revolutions, so-called. If I recall, in Hong Kong, it was the Umbrella Revolution or something like this. It always seemed very suspicious to me. But even today, Nuri, here in Canada, if I talk about that as being a setup and not really as it was portrayed as, you know, evil China tries to oppress Hong Kong and turn them into commies or whatever, there's a lot of resistance, even amongst intelligent people that are wary of propaganda and follow the news. I still get these incredulous looks and head scratches and people looking at me as though I were a conspiracy theorist or wearing a tinfoil hat.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yes, it's, the Western media, including Canadian newspapers, have been so one-sided on this, telling the official, Pentagon dictated narrative. They get nowhere near the truth, which, I say thank God for independent voices like yours, Chris, who are willing to dig deep and tell the other side of the story.
Well, you went further than me, though. You wrote a book, The Other Side of the Story, A Secret War in Hong Kong, where I was watching what your interview earlier today, an interview from some years ago now, that you gave with Daniel Dunbridge,
Dunbrill, I think it is. Yeah.
Dunbrill. And talking about walking into the protests, which got pretty violent, as people may remember. This is pre-COVID, so people might not remember anything that happened before that. But it was pretty heated for a while there, and it was quite amusing. You tell the story of walking in the wrong colored clothes.
That's right, yes. It was very violent, and at one stage there were all these protesters in my little part of town, and they were setting fires, they were trying to burn it down, and of course these days we all have access to the internet, so I was there with these people lighting fires around me, and the main news story on the international news was the suggestion that the Hong Kong protesters should get the Nobel Peace Prize, so to be reading that while someone's trying to burn down your house is pretty stunning.
Well, but not so outlandish nowadays. I mean, as we see the last couple of recipients of that prize, it seems on message, really.
That's right. Very ironic, really.
Well, you've moved to, you are not a native of Hong Kong, but you've been living there a long time. You moved there as a young man, and as the story goes, you went for a honeymoon and never returned.
That's right. Yes, I believed all that, the myths about Asia. And then when I arrived here, I just thought, wow, this is a fantastic place. So, East Asia is a lively place, well worth a visit. I recommend it to your listeners. You might end up staying like I did. I mean, I came here on honeymoon in the late 1980s, and I only went back and opened my wedding presents last year. So those wedding presents have been sitting waiting for, 38 years.
Well, it's nice you had the stability to go back and still find them. And it's been such an amazing period of history, too, in Hong Kong, the handover of the century-old lease that the British Empire and then just Great Britain and then just Little Britain held over it. And this really fueled an anxiety, I recall, at the turn of the century, where lots of people from Hong Kong were coming to where I live on the West Coast in Canada and buying properties to hedge their bets because they weren't sure what was going to happen if the Chinese, the communist Chinese, were going to come and take all of their money and their possessions and their businesses. There was a lot of uncertainty there, and it had a big effect to Vancouver, especially the main city here, but also in my little town in Victoria. And you were right in the middle of all this.
Right. And and in the end, the people who stayed here and bought property in Hong Kong instead, those are the ones who saw their property values rise rather than those who went to the West. So It's all very ironic, but it just goes to show, you know, you can't predict the future. The least expected thing will happen. That's the only thing that's guaranteed.
Well, it was touted, as I recall, one country, two systems, that being China and Hong Kong being a single country, China, but two separate systems. Is that still prevalent? Are there still two distinct systems operating there, or is there a slow merging into one country, one system?
I mean, that quote is bandied about a lot by the media, but it's actually very specific, and it says that the law will stick to its system. Now, the law is the British common law system, which is shared by some countries, Britain and former colonies, basically. I don't know if Canada is among them.
Sometimes I don't know either.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So specifically, the law will stick to the British common law system, and the economy will stick to free market, stock market, capitalism. So those were the two specified things. It wasn't that everything will stay the same, because, you know, nothing ever stays the same. So those two specific things, and they're still true. Hong Kong still has a very different legal system to the mainland Chinese, and a different financial system. They're not directly connected. Although, of course, China now has very lively stock markets as well.
Well, how much China has changed in the 25 years? This is the thing: when you say nothing can be predicted, you would expect that Hong Kong would be moved into China's orbit, you know, being such a huge entity. And yet the Chinese system, the economic system, has in the last 25 years, it's unrecognizable almost.
Yes. In fact, the week before the transfer from Britain to China, I wrote an article in the South China Morning Post saying people are missing the point here. What's really interesting is how Hong Kong will change China, not how China will change Hong Kong. And then on the day of the handover, there was a front page article in the New York Times, written by a guy called Nicholas Kristof. And it said, what's really interesting here is how Hong Kong will change China, not how China will change Hong Kong. And I thought, what? This is classic plagiarism. So I went to the Foreign Correspondents Club, where all the journalists hang out, and pointed this to people. Look, he's stolen my article. And they said, oh, no, he doesn't read your pathetic. He doesn't read the South China Morning Post. And then I pointed out in the article, it actually quotes a paragraph further down from my article. You know, but that time it was named. So clearly he had read it. Anyway, I was talking to, I think it may have been a Canadian journalist. It was another Western journalist anyway. And she said, oh, I've got to follow up Christoph's article. And I said to her, look, I wrote the same article last week. And he's just nicked it. And she said, look, when you write it, nobody cares. When Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times writes it, we all have to follow it up, you know. And I just thought,
Well, how far the mighty have fallen in the interim as well. You write a lot about propaganda, and I liked a line that you used, the MSM reports versus the truth. This is in up at Twitter, at your Twitter feed, which is under your name, Nuri Vitacci, Vitacci. And you're comparing reports, mainstream media reports, that is, versus the truth. In this case, you're talking about reports about Taiwan. And last week, it was a big furore that a high up in the Taiwanese government was addressing an EU government
Parliament
panel.
Yeah.
And this in the sense that, is this a recognition of a separate country? And this was going to put the final nail in the European economic coffin because China was going to be so upset and everything else. Now, the media does like to stir things up. I mean, it gets attention and draws eyeballs, as they would say, you know. But this story was, maybe you can explain how the difference between this report and the truth of the matter.
Yes, indeed. It's very simple. The headlines around the world, you know, Associated Press, Reuters, The Guardian, and so on, said Taiwan's vice president addressed the European Parliament. But in fact, what really happened was that she addressed a meeting in the European Parliament building, and the meeting was hosted by an NED group. So in fact, it was, it was just the three-letter agencies in the US stirring up trouble again. But no, she didn't address the European Parliament at all. But you can see, I mean, what hope is there? There's the, Reuters, Associated Press, the Guardian. These are huge, huge platforms with millions and millions of readers. And if they're giving out the NED CIA version, we little voices have to shout really loud. But anyway, I always take comfort in the fact that the locusts are big, but there are more of us ants. I think that's a line from Bugs Life, the movie Bugs Life.
Yeah. That was a good movie, and it was subversive in many ways. Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Nuri Vitacci. Nuri is a Hong Kong-based writer, educator, author of more than 50 books, including novels, nonfiction, and novels for children. I've never heard that term, novels for children. It's always children's books. He also serves as chief judge of the Hong Kong Youth Writers Award, and he's a past writer with the South China Morning Post, as Nuri mentions, and Far Eastern Economic Review and Western Mainstream Press and others. And as I say, the idea that you spend a lot of your time not only writing on X and doing these long threads, but also at your YouTube site, which is Friday every day, talking about these in a very droll English manner, I would say, just on looking at it, probably because of that accent, but pointing out the foibles of the modern media, and they're less than true assertions. You do it with grace and humor. But the topics aren't really necessarily so funny. There's been a concerted attack against China going on from the West, America primarily, of course, for a long time. And this circles around to where we began with this Hegseth declaration of war on the world, it almost sounds like. But this Hegseth character, he seems to be little more than a moron, really. It seems that his brain is Elbridge Colby, and you write about Colby, and he's a rather, if I was a member of the Chinese government or even a citizen there, I would view Elbridge Colby as a nefarious and dangerous man. Do you want to enlighten us a little bit about Mr. Colby and his project?
Right. Yeah, Mr. Colby for years now has been advocating that Taiwan is used as a pretext for starting a war with China. And then he wrote a book about this. And in his book, he says that, the West should not get too involved in protecting Taiwan because then the Chinese will be attacked for it, will be blamed, will be seen as the bad guys. And so basically stir up a war and then stand back and saying, look, they're the bad guys. And, that's worrying enough. But unfortunately, they've been taking very many practical steps towards actually making this happen. I mean, just to give an example, they ran a project to name all the flat beaches in East Asia. Why? Because there are not enough airstrips, and they can use flat beaches to send jet fighters towards China. They also have been building deep water harbors for warships on various islands, on Palau Island, on Bataan Island, and so on. These are little islands in East Asia, turning them into warship harbors. All these things are going on to prepare for war with China, a war that nobody wants, is completely unnecessary. Nobody needs it. But I mean, Hegseth is a strange character. I quite like his honesty in some ways, changing the name to the Department of War. And, he's the Secretary of War and all this. The war you know, he, the War Acquisition Department, he uses the word war everywhere, which is at least honest, isn't it?
Well, like his master, Donald Trump, he uses honesty, but he manages somehow to lie honestly, if I can put it there. you're right. And I, you know, his nickname, of course, is Keg's Breath. But he drinks quite a bit. But yeah, you write about this in the O Plan, is the 28 steps of the O Plan. And the, you know, people may remember during the Second War that America had this strategy to attack Japan of leapfrogging small islands. And so they built ports and supply depots on these little islands and atolls across the Pacific and airstrips and leapfrogged their way. And it seems to me that, like the War Department, this is a throwback to another age. It seems that for such a young man, Hegseth is, to be and so enamored in this, it's like he was sitting on his father's lap listening to World War II stories or something. But do you want to pursue further the O Plan, or is it worth saying just that this is a belligerent war plan that is actually quite available? It's not even a secret.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think we should say that it remains in place, and Elon Musk was even invited into the White House a few months ago to review it. I know Elon Musk has an up and down relationship with the White House, but he was shown all the secret plans and mentioned it in one of his posts. So it's very real and it's very current. Unfortunately for Mr. Colby, who's very gung-ho about this, all sorts of other wars have popped up. So we've, you know, the Gaza slaughter happened, of course, Ukraine war, and of course now Venezuela. So all these things are distracting the US from attacking China, which is very nice for us, but unfortunate, of course, for Venezuela and Colombia and other places, which are now in the sights of Pete Keg's Breath, you said?
Keg's Breath, yeah. I can't take credit for it, but I'll happily repeat it at every opportunity. Colby's title, he's Undersecretary of War Policy, and this is he's number two to Pete, who I'm certain is... his brain must rattle like contains marbles or something, loose marbles, because he doesn't seem to be able to put two things together. You write about this: U.S. cautiously presses ahead with Colby plan to use Taiwan to justify war to weaken China. You wrote that July 17th, and again, this is at the Friday Every Day. You can find that online. You mentioned Elon Musk. I was thinking of these mad Westerners. Elon Musk, I'm not sure how he can profit by antagonizing China. He's got Tesla has huge plants in China right now. How do we reconcile? I mean, I know you've written on economics, and you've written another book on the Kama Sutra of financial planning?
Economics or something. I can't remember that.
From 2007. I was just looking at all your books because you have so many. But the cover of that book is absolutely priceless with paper clips engaged in various instructive poses. I guess what I'm reaching for is how bound up in commerce and big business American and multinational interests are with China and in China. And yet a character like Musk, who is also intertwined with the federal government in the United States, that he's the biggest welfare queen there ever was. How these colliding interests, how do you make sense of what you see?
Yes, that's a very good point. When I get depressed with the politicians and journalists in the West who are stirring up conflict between East and West, I then walk 5 minutes down the hill from the Foreign Correspondents Club to the business hub of Hong Kong. And yet there we also have Americans there, but they're very positive about creating, you know, good relationships. So a lot of businessmen from the US and from Canada, in fact, can be found in the Hong Kong business district, and they're great. They're building factories, they're commissioning new projects. They're buying stuff. They're just creating a really healthy, positive trading system that benefits everybody in the best sort of way. So the business community is actually quite different from the politics and the journalists. And of course, there's May Musk. May is Elon's mother, and she's fallen in love with China, and she's always in this part of the world, and she nips around, and she has her own social media, and she says, oh, I'm back in Shanghai again, and she has lovely photographs of herself, and the people of Shanghai adore her, you know, this wacky little old lady who's mother of the richest person in the universe.
Oh, that's crazy, because I've never even heard of her. So she's not getting any play on this side of the pond.
Right. But yeah, for obvious reasons. She's not following the narrative, is she?
Well, we're fast running out of time, but before we go now, you wrote too about, and you've got a piece up at Friday Every Day at YouTube again, a video compilation on the creation I've lost it in front of me, but the genocide that never happened. This is with the Uyghurs and so forth. And you mentioned in that video that only seven or eight countries in the world went along with the American plan, story about this supposed victimless genocide going on, in Xinjiang, and Canada, to my great embarrassment, was one of them, foremost among them. Canada has been belligerent, following its master's orders in the United States, never more so than with Meng Wanzhou and the chief financial officer of Huawei. How, in our parting, Nuri, would you recommend Canada and Canadians mend bridges and repair relations with China? Is it possible?
Yes. Well, Canadians have a great reputation for being nice people.
Undeserved, I can tell you that.
Well, I wouldn't say that. No, Canadians I've met have all been intelligent, warm, really good-hearted people. So I actually feel quite confident that China and Canada will have a great relationship because the personalities match. They're both anti-violence. They're both intelligent. So, I'm very upbeat about that. But just don't read the mainstream media. Listen to Guerrilla Radio. Go to FridayEveryday.com.
And yes, and go to FridayEveryday.com, all one word, and look up Nuri Vitacci's work, and you can find him on YouTube as well. It's been a joy to speak with you, Nuri, and all too brief. Thanks a lot for coming on and sharing with us today, eh?
Thank you, Chris. I'll be following your show regularly. Thanks.
You're too kind. And thanks also to Ricardo Vash down there in Venezuela. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time.